Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider, and welcome back to Throwback Thursday. Usually, my co-host Kevin David Thomas is with us, but he is off on vacation enjoying his life. How great for him. So, we are here by myself, but I'm okay with that because I get to hog all the time with someone who I've admired for years and years and years, only though he's like 2 years older than me, right, Rick?
I'm sorry.
Just turned 21. Congratulations.
Absolutely.
Happy birthday.
Yes, thank you.
The wonderful, fabulous, amazing Rick Skye, who does the best Liza Minnelli impression that anybody has ever seen. Rick, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I have to ask you, where did the love for Liza Minnelli first come from?
Well, you know, I was one of the people who grew up watching The Wizard of Oz on television every year.
Of course.
Except by that point, Dorothy had passed away already. So there was no chance that she was ever going to come to my town and I was going to see this person. And then I went to see Cabaret and I remember thinking, this is the same thing that I like. This, the brown eyes and the electricity and all that. This is the same as the one. And then I found out that they were mother and daughter.
Oh my God.
So, but Liza was alive and she was performing. And so then I hooked my wagon to watching her because that, I love her. That electric-y warmth is what drew me to her.
Tell me about the first time you saw her live. Not on television, but the first time you actually got to be in the same space as her.
I begged my parents for tickets to see her at the Winter Garden when I was a little boy, and they said, no. And then you're not getting that. Pick something else. A coat, a bike. And I was like, I want tickets to see Liza at the Winter Garden. So they got me tickets. And I remember they brought me in, and the funny part was at that point, you know how the Winter Garden is, at that point, the front and the back looked kind of the same, and I had never been there before. So I ended up in the back by the stage door, and I was thinking, where is everyone? It's going to start soon, and no one's here. But a blue Lincoln Continental drove up, and a chauffeur got out, and he had two rust-colored Pekingese dogs and put them down. And then he opened the door, and Liza got out in a rust-colored fur coat. And took the dogs, and they matched. It was very glamorous. And then she came up, and someone asked for an autograph, and then I asked her for an autograph. And I had a photo of her, and I dropped it. And she picked it up, and she said, my God, who is this woman? She's gorgeous. And then she signed it back and gave it to me. And then someone said, you better go around because you're going to miss the show. And so I ran around, like, got in my seat. She came out of the car and went on stage from the car. So she got ready at home and then, like, went on. It was unbelievable.
What was the first reaction when you saw her now on stage? So you've had this little interaction with her before the show, mm-hmm. which is magical, by the way. Anyone who matches their dogs to their dress
is
pretty incredible to begin with.
If you've ever seen the movie A Matter of Time, it's exactly what she's wearing in the last scene of the movie.
Oh, my God, really?
She's like in black pants with this rust-colored coat. And so here she is. You know, in that outfit.
Okay, so now you're sitting down, the curtain goes up. Yeah. What hooks you about her?
Oh, that, you know, her energy field, whatever it is,
yeah.
that when she comes on, the whole audience was swept up in it. Don't forget, she had just done Cabaret and Liza with a Z, so she was the biggest star on the planet. And, you know, she's become a legend and all that, but at that time, she was the it girl she was the one. So when she came out, everybody just was... And Broadway was different then.
People
were very tough, you know. I remember there were two big banks of speakers on either side of the stage, and people were not happy about that. I heard some things about, oh, well, it's mic'd, and of course she sounds loud because it's so mic'd, and this and that. And, you know, I couldn't have cared less. I mean, I wanted her to knock me out, like, you know, on those live albums that you hear. But it was that energy and the way the show was planned. She came out and you just heard her first. And she sang, if you could read my mind. But first you heard la 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 off stage. And then she came out and she had this big scarf on and, you know, it was crazy. And then at the end of the number, I remember she just went back to that la 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 she turned around and like struck this pose, and like the lights went out, and oh, it was, you know, just a slice of lightning coming out of there, and then it was over. You know.
Did you ever write her a fan letter?
What I usually do is I send her something to say thank you. So when she did Minelli on Minelli, I did a lot of research, and I found all the programs and booklets from all of her father's shows that he did on Broadway, and I sent them to her office, and I got a beautiful letter saying, today I wasn't feeling that great, and I went to the office, and there was your package, and I didn't have any of those things, and you really cheered me up today, and I thought, wow, you know, that's exactly, you know, I could give her something, you know, after so many years of the wonderful nights.
You know, she's so iconic for the singing community, mm-hmm. but I'm wondering, she's such a brilliant actress, you can't say cabaret. What do you think her best performance on screen is?
Like, favorite and best could be two different things. But
give me both. We'll start with best, and then we'll go to favorite.
I think probably New York, New York, because she really is almost everything is done so sparingly and so truthfully. And so, you know, no matter what you think about the film, like, her work in that film would... That she should have gotten an Oscar for that,
yeah.
because it's really amazing. The Sterile Cuckoo, it captures her, you know, that kind of crazy personality of hers, that wackiness, like, and she's so moving in it. And, you know, when you see that telephone scene and you know she did that in one take, and you go, you know how hard it is to get yourself worked up like that and do that, so, you know, it's... I don't know how she did it in one take. It's just incredible.
Now, were your parents supportive of your tell me about this.
No.
That was very fast. No,
every year I asked for, you know, I want the album to accompany. No, you know, get me the album. You're not getting that. No, forget Judy Garland. Enough Judy Garland. You have all those songs already. But this has a different cover. This album has a different cover. You know, I was one of those kids. So they weren't. And we're not Hollywood people. And it's cute that you like to perform, but... You know,
where did you grow up?
I was born on off of Bleecker Street on Downing Street.
Oh, wow.
And then when I was 8 years old, we moved out to Long Island.
So okay, but you're a New York boy through and through.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first musical that you saw?
Yes.
And?
Okay, so I saw Lauren Bacall in Applause when I was a little boy.
Okay, now tell me about that experience.
Well, I remember I was a little teeny kid, but I got to go to the Palace Theater, and Judy's picture was still there, so that was fantastic.
Okay.
I was all excited. And then I went there, and I remember thinking, and I loved it. I hadn't seen All About Eve. I didn't know what it was about. Like, I loved it for what it was,
because
I couldn't compare it to anything. But then I remember Lauren Bacall, you know, it was probably her eighth performance that week. It was a matinee, because I was a little boy. And I thought, they were selling the album in the lobby. And I thought, well, who would want the album to this? Because it was just a lot of shouting, you know, or whispering. It was like her singing in the theater was so crazy that you'd be like, it was effective because she was like, welcome to the theater, you know, like that. And you go, well, I'm here and it's moving me, but I can't imagine playing this at home and wanting to listen to it. Hurry back, you know, that whole thing. So, but she was, I mean, you can't. Act that whatever she had, you just can't. The elegance, the way, the steely quality, the crisp way she had of delivering a line, you know. And then watching her, it was so fun because in those days they used to have, you know, Lucy and Wildcat. They pick her up and throw her around, and the fun of it is like seeing Lucy do that, you know. So here's Lauren Bacall, and they're picking her up, and she's at a gay bar, and she's like, you know, doing the Froog and all this kind of, you know, it was so fun. And it was the first time really there was a gay character on stage with Leroy Reams playing her hairdresser friend, and I thought that was so shocking. Like, I didn't even know there was such a thing, and you know, and there was one line where she said, come out with me after the show, and he said, I can't, I have a date, and then she went, so bring him along, and I remember the audience went, oh, you know, like, it was not something you spoke about or even thought about then, so.
But a thunderbolt nonetheless.
They were like, you know.
Then
What's
did you
that
go?
Mean? He likes
just the whispering, the blue hairs whispering.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you then seek out All About Eve? Did you then seek out the movie?
No, because you couldn't then.
Aha! Uh-huh.
You couldn't. You know, on a Sunday they might show a Betty Davis movie, but you know, you had no control over it.
You know, you've mentioned Judy Garland. You've mentioned Lauren Bacall. What other strong actresses were you seeing on television in the movies that really, really appealed to you, and why did they appeal to you?
It took me a long time to get past Judy Garland. Because I remember sneaking downstairs to watch The Late Late Show. And I saw Meet Me in St. Louis, and I thought, oh, Dorothy grew up. Like, it was obviously her still. And I thought, oh, she made more movies. And then I saw East of Parade, and saw the Ziegfeld Follies, and all these movies. And then I got a book about her. There was a Films and Career of Judy Garland. And I just read it over and over and over again and tried to see those movies in the clock. But I was such a huge fan of hers that it took me a very long time to appreciate anybody else. Mm. I loved Barbara Streisand, of course, but she was contemporary then. So, like, it took me a long time to find, like, Barbara Stanwyck.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Joan Crawford. Like, I didn't know anything about them. Yeah. And when people would ask me about them, you love old movies. You've seen... No, I haven't. I've only seen... I love Judy Garland.
But Judy Garland was that bar for you.
Yes. I still, to this day, I mean, there's no one who could do... You know what I mean? Once you're hooked on her, you just... And anyone who doesn't appreciate her, I really feel sorry for them.
Absolutely.
I really do. Because the millions of hours of, you know... Especially when you're a teenager, that kind of, you know, your emotions are at their peak and your energy is like this. And you go, oh, she gets me. She gets me. You know, she feels that way. She feels deeply like that. She has so much energy.
What's your favorite film performance of hers? Non-Wizard of Oz, non-Meet Me in St. Louis. Because much like her daughter, people forget that she is a brilliant actress. Yeah. There's more there.
This is going to sound crazy. No. I love Presenting Lily Mars.
Oh.
She's so funny in that movie. And so, of course, I could go on singing. I love because of acting.
Sure.
Because it's like the really Judy, you know, the one that we want to see, you know, the real one. That and, you know, A Star is Born, of course, has its... You know, and I love The Pirate. And The Pirate is the only one of her films. I saw at Lincoln Center. They did a whole retrospective of her. And that was the only one that the young audience really thought, oh, this is a good movie.
Oh, really?
Yes, because to them, some of them, the pace is too slow for them because modern day, they don't really get Mickey and Judy. And it's too this for them, it's too that. So a lot of the movies have slowly paid. Like, I think Vincent Minnelli's films sometimes suffer from that. I love them.
Oh, sure.
But I'll show them to people, and it's a gentler time, you know, and the comedy is gentler, and he takes long time setting things up. So for young people who are like this, they don't want to sit through it. But The Pirate, because she's kind of campy in it, and the lines are, like, modern and she's sexy and all of this, they thought, oh, this is great, you know, this is...
It's a pretty wonderful film.
I really wish it
got more credit than it does, because people sort of forget it when they
have to forget this nonsense that when it came out in 1948, it got some, like, wacky reviews and people didn't go. It's like, yeah, that was 1948. Yeah. Like, it's a great movie.
We can move on.
It was ahead of its time. Yes. Now it's time.
Yes.
So that's it.
You know? So everyone who's listening, please watch The Pirate.
Yes.
Pause us. Watch The Pirate. Come back to
would
us.
Would I change a few things? Yes. I mean, Judy would have, like, another number and Gene Kelly would have one less. But, you know... It's a great movie. It's
kind of genius. Now, would
you have to see it on the big screen, though.
Ah.
Because Vincent Minnelli worked very visually. So a lot of the story is told with looks. And if you see it on the TV, you go, what's going on here? I don't know. Like, this is just a long scene of nothing. And when you see it on the big screen, you see the thoughts in Judy's eyes, and she's looking this way. And then they show so-and-so and what he's thinking. And this.
Oh, that's incredible.
It's a different experience.
Much
more... Yes, involving on a big screen.
Interesting. That's really, really interesting.
Which is what it was planned for. So, I mean, that's how,
yeah.
That's how I like to
you kind of forget. Me too. Anytime they're playing anything like at MoMA or at IFC, you have to. You just absolutely
you
have
see
to.
See so much more.
Oh, yeah.
And even a Betty Davis movie that seems kind of stinky and campy on TV, you go see it on the big screen and it
makes so
all
much
of
sense.
That and you go, oh, no, her performance is really great.
It's brilliant.
It's the TV that ruins it.
Now, did you go to college? Were you a college guy?
Yes.
Where'd you go
to
college?
NYU. I studied with Stella Adler.
Okay.
This is not
joking around.
This is a very funny thing. The first year I was there, there was a little index card on the bulletin board, and it said, Miss Adler needs someone to walk her dogs, and you can get tuition in exchange for that. So go see Mary in the office. So I went to see Mary, and she said, oh, all right, well, Miss Adler has to approve. So meet me at 3:00 at this beauty parlor. She's having her hair done. So we walk into the beauty parlor, and Stella's having her hair washed in the sink, and the woman, like, knocks on her forehead, you know, like, Stella, I have the boy for the dog. And she opened one eye and said, gorgeous, and then closed her eye. And then we walked out, and she said, you have the job. And I said, well, what does that mean? She said, Stella likes to be surrounded by nice-looking people, so she had to see you.
Oh.
Isn't that crazy?
What an interesting requirement yeah. for a job. I love it.
You know, when I was like 17, so I guess it was okay. So, but what happened from that was that I also then got the job of driving her out to the Hamptons on the weekends. So I got to spend the drive out with her. I got to spend the weekend with her. I met Greta Garbo. I met Anne Jackson and Eli Wallach. I met all kinds of writers, because she loved writers more than actors. And then on Sunday morning, she would say, "Now, sweetheart, we have time. We're not going back till 1 o'clock. This week, we're doing The Rainmaker in class. So you read Starbuck. Get up, do the monologue." She would direct me, do this, do that. And then in class on the Wednesday, she would say, "Now we were doing The Rainmaker over the weekend. Rick, get up. He's Starbuck, blah, 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 blah." So I got like this private coaching. And the funny thing is today, I don't think I would have the nerve to like even answer that postcard. But but then I was thinking, oh, if she sees me at her house, she'll know me. I won't be one of these 200 kids, you know, people in the school. So maybe that will be helpful, that she'll, maybe she'll pick on me more because she knows me or something. But it, I used to go to parties at her house. And Sanford Meisner would be there. It was crazy. Her household was crazy.
Were you starstruck? Were you intimidated?
I guess so. I was thrilled to be there. I remember Sanford Meisner came in, and he had a tuxedo on. People used to be formal then, so if you went to dinner at Stella's house, you got dressed. And he sat down, and her cousin Pearl was there, who also taught at the school. Pearl Pearson, her name was. She was part of the Yiddish theater. She talked like this. And he came in and sat down, and he unbuttoned the button under his bow tie. And he lit a cigarette and smoked it through the hole in his neck from having cancer. And she sat down next to him, and she went, "So, Sandy, what's new?" And I thought, "What's new? He's smoking a cigarette out of all of his neck." And it was like lurch with the smoke coming up. I was like, "What are you talking about?" It was crazy, crazy, crazy. It was unbelievable. And then she had these two little dogs that she always kept in her lap. And the maid would say, "Stella, you can't have them dirty dogs in your lap. You can't serve the food with the people." Because she liked to scoop the food out. Like, she always had chicken pot pie and would scoop it on the plate and pass it around to people. But as it came to you, people would see, like, this long dog hair. And they'd go, "Oh, that's not, I'm glad that's not mine." And, you know, like that. And she said, "I have to cook for these people twice. Nobody eats the chicken pie." And then John Travolta came in the kitchen. He said, "Mary, make me some eggs. I can't eat. It's got the dad, a dog in there." Engelberg came in. Engelbert Humperdinck. Engelberg came in. He said, "Mary, make me some eggs." So, you know, and they would fight and fight. But the funny part was the maid had made her husband on his deathbed said to her, "You know, Miss Wilson goes through people like so quickly. Promise me you'll stay with." You'll stay with her. And she would say, "The only reason I stay in this house is I promised Mr. Wilson." You know, like, "I got my own family. I don't need to." It was really a crazy house.
I am dead. I would be dead in that house. That is incredible to me. Now, wait, okay, so let's go.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Back to Stella Adler's teaching for a second, though. So what made her such an incredible teacher?
Well, she was brilliant, first of all.
In what way?
She was not funny. She lived to work. She researched everything thoroughly for her classes. I remember her reading and making notes. She was a very intellectual person. And when she went to a party, actually, you would see a completely different person. She would put on kind of a dumb blonde act, actually. She would tell silly jokes, and people would say, Stella, you know, you're such a brilliant teacher. Then when we talk to you at dinner, you say these silly things. It was on purpose. She said, I don't want to talk politics with people, and they repeat something they read in Newsweek. That's not what I'm interested in. You know, anyone can spit back what I saw in the news, and that's not really an opinion. If I want to know something about Israel, I'm going to call the prime minister and find out what's going on. You know, I'm going to go to the source of it. So her public persona was more just sort of silly. But she would spend the whole weekend when we were out in the country preparing for her week of classes. But she could see in you what you needed. And when people say, oh, she was tough, she did that. She wanted you to say, you don't know what you're talking about. I can do this even better than you. I know what I can do. And then she felt, okay, now you're a person. Now you're somebody I could deal with.
What do you think you needed?
I guess a sense of my own, that I had to own it, that I already knew what I was too much of a people pleaser. And, you know, to do scenes so that the teacher likes you is not a good way to do it.
Yeah.
So I think she broke me of that and her Shakespeare teacher.
That's incredible.
He used to say, you know, nice is nice, but it's a much of a much. We don't need to see nice. We want to see everything else. I want to see you murder somebody. I want to see, you know, we want to see something else. So I think that's what she did. And if you could work in front of her and get away with it, you know, you probably didn't have to be afraid of anything the rest of your life. She's really... rage at people.
Yeah. We've heard from a couple of other people, but you can tell me first.
But it was for a reason.
Yeah.
It was for a reason. And then she would hug you at the end and say, you see, darling, I got you where you needed to go. And, you know, like that.
Do you still take those lessons with you today while you're performing on stage?
And actually, her improv teacher was Sandra Lee. Remember Sandra Lee?
Yeah.
So, and I just saw her actually at a function and I told her, you know, everything I've done in the theater has been based on the notes that you gave me and that Stella gave us. And the great thing about Stella's technique is actually, as you go through life, I find myself going, oh, that's what she meant by that.
Mm.
Oh, you know, oh, I inadvertently, now I know what that means because I just did it naturally. Oh, my goodness. You know, but at 17, I didn't have the tools to know what all of that was going to mean or what it meant. You know, you're just trying to do an assignment and it means that. And then when you're actually practicing it, you go, you know, that totally helped me. So Sandra used to say, when you're in trouble, remember, hungry, eat, tired, sleep. Keep it simple. You're trying to be all fancy, just be simple. And so I saw her at this function and I said, Sandra, hungry, eat. And she went, that's right, that's right. You know, so I think she's in her 80s now. Wow.
Bless her.
Yeah.
Bless her. We're trying to get her for this one as well.
Oh,
yeah, because we'd love to sit down and talk with her. Where did the idea then come from admiring Liza Minnelli to becoming Liza Minnelli?
Didn't, actually. I wrote a show called, it was a musical review, it was called Macabre, a tabloid fable. And there were five people in it, and they all had five roles. So they were either on stage doing their thing, or they were changing their clothes. And Liza had just done this show, Minnelli on Minnelli, and the critics liked it, but there was a song that she did called With a Shine on Your Shoes. And in the movie, The Bandwagon, Fred Astaire is in a barber chair, and he does this little dance in the barber chair, then gets up and dances. And so they had this little white chair that rolled out, and she was in it, and the boys would, like, wheel her around like and do a dance, and then she'd get up out of the chair, and she'd finish the dance. But critics were like, oh, she can't even dance anymore. They're wheeling her around in this chair. It's the oldest trick in the book. What is she kidding? So I sort of wrote this song called Mine Chair, which was based on Mine Hair, but it was about the love that she had for this rolling chair because it takes her wear. She did, you know, this whole thing. And nobody could do it because they were all changing their clothes. It happened like right in the middle of the show. Oh, you can't, you can't, you can't. So I said, ugh, okay, I'll do it. So I plopped a wig on my head and I went like this with some red lipstick and put on a sequin schmata and did it. And it brought down the house every night. So when that was over, people said, you should still do that number in a comedy show or something because it's so funny. And so I did that. And then people said, you know, all the other comics do 10 minutes, you do 3. You should write another song. So I did. You should get up out of the chair and you should talk. So I did. And then finally someone said, you know, I think an audience would really like a whole evening of this if you could find a way to do it. Plus, people who imitate people, impersonate people, they have a hook. you could travel the world doing that show. If you're just, hi, I'm Rick Skye, I'm singing songs of Gershwin tonight in a cabaret, does anyone want to hear that? I don't know. You know, I mean, you might get your friends to come, but no. Something that has that in it is already a pre-sold thing.
People absolutely
might want to come see that. So I did it, and that's how I got into doing it. But it's like not the normal way that people do it. I don't look like her. I don't really sound like, you know, it's like I have to work really hard to create the illusion.
Do you consider yourself a drag performer or an actor who's playing
an actor.
Character?
And that's the funny thing. The first time I did the show, I had trouble buying stockings. I had trouble getting away. I was mortified and embarrassed to get these things. It was crazy. I used to bring my girlfriend with me, and she would say, I'm trying to buy a Liza Minnelli wig for a friend of mine. And everyone, like, you mean him? You know, like, I was saying it. But I remember people came up to me after the first couple of shows and said, it's strange. You're a really outgoing performer. All the other shows you've done, you've sort of banged people over the head, and you come out and you do your thing. And here you're playing the most outgoing performer ever, and you're a little shy with it. And so the audience takes over, like, unless they're responding well to you, you don't sort of come out and do it fully. What's that about? And I didn't realize that I had some kind of shame around wearing, like, a bra and, like, a dress and stuff like that. And everyone goes, like, oh, you're gay, you know, you're going to love wearing a dress. I was like, not really. I didn't know that that would be a problem. And so they said, you know, if you played a cowboy in Oklahoma, you had a gun, you'd never carry a gun. Why could you carry a gun, but you can't wear high heels? What's that about? That's what the character has. And the minute they said that, I could do it.
And then you embraced it.
Then I was like, oh, right, she does. Right, that's her gun, is the high heel, you know, that's the thing. So from then on, it was easier.
How many years have you been playing her now?
Since 2000.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, the man, I started to complain. Yeah, I always complain about everything. And the Sydney at the club, I said, how come so-and-so's doing this and so-and-so's asked to do that? And he said, do you think that these people became who they are in 1 minute, like in one show? It could take 15 years before people accept you doing this and till you get it so that you're doing it so well that it means something to people. I mean, I've sung all around the world and it's been really great.
Oh, yeah.
But now I feel like when I do it, it's very deep and there's so many things I don't have to worry about anymore because I'm just in it like every second.
When you portray her, do you portray her as we remember her from like years ago, or because she's evolved over time, does your character evolve with her?
I think it's evolved. I think when I first started, I was trying to do her at Radio City. I wanted people to remember how at her peak,
yes,
like the greatest she could be, right? I mean, I love her, so I want people to say that. So through the years, it's evolved a little bit. And I sort of like when I make fun of little things, it will be things that have happened since then,
sure,
over the years. But I mean, I want people to remember what was great about her, not what's.
And your show is a celebration of her. It's not making fun of her. It's not ridiculing her.
No, but there are parody songs in it.
Yeah.
What I parody are the types of songs that she sings. So there's a funny Charles Aznavour song.
Yes.
And I took a song about a woman who learned sign language so she could say, I love you.
Yes.
But I take it a step further, that the woman, when she learns sign language, discovers that actually the guy only married her to get a green card. And so now she tells him off because she can. So like things like that. So that's funny for me. It, in a way, it's like the show I wish like Liza could do if she had really funny writers who wrote about like little, like she, in her last show, she would say things about her
and
life.
She just wants to let it all go, no filter.
Yeah. And if she did that, and if Kander and Ebb had really written her like parodies of things to talk about her life in a way that was funny and, you know, like Bette Midler would do or something like that.
Has she seen the show yet?
No, and none of her people have either.
Has she ever seen you? Well,
I mean, we've met, but.
But she hasn't seen you as her.
No, I don't think so. I think she's not interested in that. You know,
yeah, I totally get that. No. She's missing something pretty incredible because you're pretty good at it.
You know, but I think when people write about you all the time and
they have opinions,
you know, do you want to sit there and go, even if I'm saying something good-natured about something, you know, I only deal with her public persona.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Not the private persona.
But, you know, do you want to hear that again? I don't know.
Absolutely. Now, you know, you do so much club work, you do so many of these nightclub gigs. How do you win over a crowd that maybe isn't on your side from the beginning? Or how do you deal with crowds that are maybe a little rough around the edges, we'll say?
Well, mostly I've done it in theaters.
Uh-huh.
In this country, I've done nightclub work.
Yes.
In London and in Ireland and in Scotland, I've only played theaters. And it's actually plays very well in theaters because of all the writing in it. It's better if people are sitting there listening to the lyrics and saying, oh, that was clever,
and you
rather
do all
than hear people, I can go to the bathroom, I'm having a drink, yeah, I'm yeah. talking, you know, that kind of thing.
And you do all the parody lyrics yourself,
yes,
correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Who's your favorite lyricist of all time?
Maybe Ira Gershwin.
Yeah, you can't get better
maybe,
than Ira Gershwin, really.
Although Cole Porter, probably, too.
That sort of world.
Yeah.
Have you ever wanted to embrace another persona besides Liza in any of your acts?
Well, if you've seen any of my other shows, there's always a section where I sing a song, but then there's some, I recreate a scene from
of course,
a movie.
Of course.
I do Gloria Swanson, or I do James Mason in A Star Is
yeah.
Born. There's always something. But that's because in my shows, I just don't limit it to, okay, these are my feelings. I'm going to sing songs that express my feelings to the audience. It's about me and my feelings. I like to explore, like, what are my fantasies? What are my dreams? If I could do this, if I could sit on the edge of the stage and sing Born in a Trunk in Pocatello, Idaho, I'm doing it, you know, because I want to do that. If I could do something like Liza Minnelli, I want to do that. You know, that's where that comes from.
When you perform in your act, or your show, I should say, what is your favorite song to perform? Which one do you always look a little bit more forward to than the others?
Probably Maybe This Time, I would say.
What is it about that song that's so special for you?
You know, it's from Cabaret, and it's just such a powerful song. I also like But the World Goes Round, which is really hard to sing, and I don't know why she would ever choose to sing. That's the other thing you learn. Like, when people take what performers do so lightly, and you would say, you know, I only do like an hour and a half sometimes, or an hour, and I am utterly and completely exhausted in every way when it's over. And when I think of the gargantuan shows that she used to do with the dancing and the singing and singing, like they used to keep her on stage every second, you know, for 2.5 hours. It's like every day. And
oh, it's crazy.
Show after show after show after show after show. And, you know, when you're doing that, you have to time your whole life. You get up, can I eat now? What's the time? What's the cutoff for lunch? I have to get my makeup done. It takes 2 hours. You know, it was my voice in the place that has to be, saying at 5 o'clock. It's, your whole life is really programmed. You could see why when you have a day off, you want to, like, you go a little.
How long does it take you to become her?
About 3 hours, because I take my time. But I enjoy that 3 hours, because what would you be doing for those 3 hours, worrying, is it going to go well?
Yeah.
So as long as I'm doing this, I'm not thinking about anything negative about how will I do, how will I be.
Absolutely.
So I reserve that for like the 5 minutes before I go on.
Let me ask you, you know, you come from a really long line of great performers behind you, people like Charles Pierce and Jim Bailey. Did you have any interaction with any of those people as you were coming up? Any words of advice or guidance?
I saw Jim Bailey do Judy Garland at Carnegie Hall. And it was a very exciting night. What I remember about it was when he came out, everybody went, oh, he's a little too tall, and he seems like a man, his voice is a little low. But by the third song, you thought it was Judy Garland.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, so your mind takes over. Your mind wants it so much to be Judy that even the details that aren't quite right, you correct. And I think that that's what happens when people see me.
Mm.
You know, the first minute they're judging you. I don't know, does he look like her? Does he this, that? By the end of the show, there's always some kind of like little frenzy. And it happened with the Judy and Liza show too, when I was doing that show. There was always a minute where it flipped over, people thinking, oh, they're really like, it's really like Judy and Liza. You know, they would scream and all that kind of stuff. And you go, well, not really. We're not really. But their minds do it. They want it so much.
Before we go, what's pizzazz?
Pizzazz is a word that actually Kay Thompson made up. She was playing like Diana Vreeland in Funny Face, the movie Funny Face. And so it's a mixture of bizarre and pizzazz. It's full of pizzazz. So, and then she actually wrote a song called Pizzazz after that movie. So we sing it in the show. And I used to quote it. I used to like read it like a poem at the end of the show. And the audience has always responded to it. And I get applause on this little poem after I've been singing for like 45 minutes. So we get applause on the poem. Cool. And so I thought, you know, let me start this show off with that song.
And where are you going to be performing next? Where do we get to see you?
What, Don't Tell Mama, we're going to be every month. So far we've done two shows. It's a big variety show.
So yeah.
We have like two guests. Next one is with Rick Crom, the comedian, and Karen Wyman. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
She had a big hit. And then we're doing New Year's Eve at Mama's, which I've been doing maybe for 7 years now. And it's always fun. They have dinner and the show and champagne and the countdown and all of that. And it's fun.
So you literally love doing this. This is what you wake up every morning to do, is to perform.
Yes. Yes. And I think performers are born. And I think if I wasn't performing, you wouldn't want to know me, because all of that goes into the show would be going into me talking to you.
Yeah.
And people wouldn't like it. Yeah.
What are some of the goals for the show as 2018, 2019, and 2020 roll around?
I would like my set to be completely new material with the dancing boys. And to get, and to for it to be all positive number, like maybe do With a Shine on Issues, maybe do Bye Bye Blackbird, or something like a big, my set should be me and the boys and maybe a solo, but that. I don't want to be doing what I was doing in the Tommy Femi show. I don't want to be doing that.
So you love rotating. You love finding new things
to explore.
I
want to do something new. And anybody who doesn't want to do that with me, I get really bored with. So.
Oh, absolutely.
Even the things that I usually, even the things that are set in the show, unless they're evolving, I'm not really. I've been doing some songs for the last 15 years. And still, to this day, I'll come off stage, and if it was a good show, what I mean by it is I did that differently than I've ever done it in the last 15 years. I found a new way to
And that'll keep it fresh for you.
Yes, because if you're in that moment, all of a sudden you'll go, oh, my God, like, that's what that means, you know?
You know, I wanted to ask you really quickly, because what I find so interesting about your show is your show has a very strong thematic element to it, but the venues you play vary in size. I mean, you can be playing something like Don't Tell Mamas, which is intimate, and then you could be going off into Dublin or London, where you're maybe playing to 300, 400, 500 people. How do you change the show to fit the scope of the environment that you're in?
I think I don't. I think I'm so concentrated when I'm doing it. And it's so inside, actually, like the show's really happening behind my eyes, really, that the audience gets drawn into you.
So they will come to you. You don't go to them.
Yeah. I actually have a little joke where I sort of blink and hold the laugh because I'm doing this little blinking thing. And in London, in an 800-seat theater, I just stood still and I said the joke. And then I did my little three blinks. And I could have stood there for the next 10 minutes while I left. It was just that kind of connection.
That focus comes into you.
But it's from the inside. It has nothing to do with how loud you are or how big you are. Really, really, really. People will come and...
And also trusting the material and also trusting the audience's intelligence that you don't
have
to push for that.
You have to perform a lot. There's no school to go to do what I'm doing. You have to do it and do it and do it. Where do you go to learn how to hold an audience for an hour and 45 minutes by yourself? I mean, there's no way. You have to just do that.
You have to be in the trenches doing it night after night.
Yeah.
What do you know now that you wish you knew starting out?
You know, people are always trying to put this American dream trip on you. Like, unless you're on Broadway, unless you're Tom Cruise in a movie, unless you're this, like, they keep asking you, when are you going to be on Broadway? When are you going to? It's like, you know what? If I had known that it would be okay just to create what I want to create and keep doing it, and it's not about how much money it's going to make you or whatever, that's how I've survived, I think, till now, because that hasn't been my goal. My goal's been to, like, what's the next show? What's the next thing I want to put out there for people? Some of them make money, some of them don't, some allow me to travel, some whatever, but it's not about some goal of I'm going to be this or that, and someday maybe I will be, but I think there's too much pressure on that.
But you wake up every morning feeling fulfilled, feeling happy with what you do.
Well, when I think back about everything that I've done, all what I see are thousands and thousands and thousands of people laughing, crying, telling me after the show, I needed a laugh tonight and you gave it to me and I'll never be able to thank you enough. Or what joy that show brought me. We saw three Broadway shows this weekend and our favorite show was yours. Because you don't like that. And then you think, okay, well, that's great. Isn't that a great thing that you've done? You know, that's wonderful. I feel good about that.
Nothing better than that.
No.
The only thing better than that is actually sitting in the audience getting to watch your brilliance. So go ahead to Don't Tell Mama, once a month.
Mm-hmm. So the next one is December 29th, and then New Year's Eve, and then it'll be January, February, March. And you can go to their website.
Great.
Don't Tell Mama NYC, and they have all the shows listed there.
And do you have all that fun social media stuff?
Yes, like the young people do.
But I don't understand how any of it works.
Yes.
You have Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We can follow you on all of those.
Absolutely. The Rick Sky on Instagram, Rick Sky on Facebook.
Amazing. Rick, thank you so much for spending much time with us today. And I cannot wait to see the show. You have brought so much joy to so many people. And so on behalf of all of our listeners, let me say thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome, listeners.
Till next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.